Hello and welcome to The Photorian. I'm Greg Delves and I'll be your host in this first series. Born in Adelaide, Australia, portrait photographer Ben Baker travelled extensively as a child through the remote areas of the Northern Territory. Travelling with his father, David Baker, who was working with Indigenous communities as a mediator. These early experiences defined Ben's ability to communicate and observe different cultures that would be the foundation for his later work as a portrait photographer. After finding his way to New York, Ben had an opportunity to assist Annie Leibovitz. This opened the door to work with legendary photographers Mary Ellen Mark, Harry Benson, and Mark Seliger on projects for Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, Time, and Life magazines. Ben's portrait career began with assignments for New York Magazine, Newsweek, Esquire, and Time magazine. Ben has photographed some of the most prominent leaders in politics, business, and the media. Notable portrait sittings of presidents Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Bill Clinton, and George Bush. Also, First Lady Michelle Obama, Warren Buffett, Oprah Winfrey, Lady Gaga, Ralph Lauren, Jay-Z, and Rupert Murdoch. His work has been collected by the National Portrait Gallery of Australia and the African American Museum of History and Culture in Washington. Awards include the American Photography Collections, New York Press Club, and Photo District News. And I'm thrilled to welcome Ben to the Photorian. Firstly, thank you so much for doing this, because, you know, as you can tell, I've been a bit of a newbie at this, but when I wrote my initial list, there was sort of, you know, 10 people I wanted to talk to, and you know, you were way up there as one of those early people, because of what you've done is really extraordinary, and I really wanted to sort of shine a light on it to another side, you know, from what I've seen in it, because I remember, obviously, I remember a sort of a bright, keen, young assistant going back a few years that also doubled as a model, if I remember, on a couple of images for me.
Yes, that's right.
And I remember talking to you, and you were very keen that you were going to go and do portrait photography then. And I kind of loved it because, as you know, I came from the still life world and was sort of finding my way around the fashion thing. But you didn't really have an interest in that. Like, you had this thing that you wanted to do. So I was like, Ben is the guy I want to talk to him, because I want to sort of now stitch it all together, because I think it's a great story and a great chance to do that. So
thank you. Yeah, thanks for the kind words. And also great gratitude for those early days of teaching and learning and putting up with someone who doesn't have the passion of your passion. It's, you know, a very different kind, but thank you.
Yeah, no. I have fond memories of the EH wagon. So,
who thought it was a good idea to have an ancient car that would break down? And say, oh yeah, and I'll be there at 5 a.m. Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it'll be there. Don't worry, Greg.
You'll make it work.
Some photographers do not know the stories of me madly repairing that car in the middle of peak hour traffic in Sydney. Going, oh come on! I do not want to make that call. So, yeah.
Oh dear. So you know, obviously, you know, sort of my first question is, before I go to the first question, how did you end up back in Sydney? Did you get COVID stuck down there, or did you just need a break from the States, or?
Yes. I'm not a COVID refugee. Well, I am in some senses. I was in the US for 20 years. I'm sure you actually ticked over. It'd be interesting. Your numbers are similar, maybe. I've now spent half of my life in the US. I think it comes down to about a month apart. You know, right. I've lived longest continuously in New York City than Australia, which is a wild concept and something I'm very proud of, as we're both, you know, American citizens as well. And I hold that dearly and proudly. And, you know, New York does, I mean, breaks you or makes you, and somehow it didn't spit me out the other side. But it does beat down on you, and you do miss family, and there's only so many times. I think you actually, you know, I'm not on social media that much, but there was a posting, and you wrote a note on there that was, only an expat who travels around the world gets it. Progressively, when I would get on that plane from Australia to Sydney, I'd be getting on the plane, and I'd be having my sunglasses on, because I was celebrating and crying at the same time. It was this weird sense of home and what home was. And I'm like, I'm going home from home to home to see home, to tell people I love them and then leave them.
Yeah. Right.
And it just got progressively more like gut-wrenching to walk away. And so I'm really proud of what I've done as work. I haven't relocated completely. I'm here. The plan is to come home for a set amount of time and try to manage both continents, which I know is going to be a big challenge. I've done that. You've done that over time. But I just needed some home time. I needed to be present. I needed to not come home and do a flying 2-week trip of hugging and saying I love you and then leaving people and, you know, nephews who are children. I want to be present as an uncle, and I want to be present as a brother and a son. And maybe it doesn't go on forever. So take it while you can. And, having the citizenship and having had some success that I was content with, we'll take it day by day. And there's different ways of, I guess, we measure what is important. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's, I kind of thought that might have been the case. Yes. There's a certain... just even looking through your work as I was going over, I wanted to really get familiar again with what you've been doing. And there's a sense of sort of melancholy that I see in you. And I mean that as a great compliment because, I'm always attracted in music or art or, you know, whatever it is I'm looking at to that sense of melancholy. And, you know, you've done such a sort of a brilliant cross section of, you know, I can sort of see the commissioned portraits, and I can see the stuff where people needed something for a particular reason. But then things like the series of portraits you did with your mum were just amazing. Like and we'll go into this later because I want to talk to you sort of more about art, but have you exhibited those, or have you done anything with them, or they've just been a very personal body of work that you've done with?
No, they're just really personal. It's right. The linking to those images was me walking out of one of the great joys of living in New York is access to great work and to great exhibitions, and you get to, you know, and Americans breathe and live, and the conversations they have about, you know, as they do in Europe. Richard Avedon had a great retrospective at the Met. I'm sure you went into the same show.
Yeah.
And I've always, like, he's one of our heroes, and as a portrait photographer, he's, you know, one of the icons. And I have struggled so much with his work because I never felt the connection to humans. He's one of the great human photographers, but I just find there's this cold separation, which isn't a criticism, it's just a different way of shooting.
Yeah.
Then I got to this room of his father. He photographed his father who was aging.
Right.
And it was the most intense, personal, brave series of pictures I'd ever seen. And finally I went, now I know who Richard Avedon is. And it took that much work. So I would come home and I started taking pictures, and then mum had cancer, had a lymphoma, and we've, you know, like a lot of people around the world, there's no family that has escaped the clutches of cancer. Yeah. And that picture took on a different meaning. So the deal is I just take a headshot everywhere. I've taken up those headshots are shot in, like, so mum would, you know, she works in university, so she'd be at a conference somewhere randomly in the world, and I'd go and meet her and put together some random white wall and some random light and just try to keep the consistency. So they'll obviously continue. Mum's, we keep repairing the glasses that she has on the face, but yeah, thank you. Those pictures are, for me, the less, so much of my work is so much of a, not a production, but there's so much more to go into it. It's a joy sometimes to take simple pictures. They seem simple, but obviously underneath there's a whole lot of emotion there, but they appear to be very simple.
One of the things that, even though we photograph from different worlds, I think we probably both share is, having taken so many pictures that we sort of have to do, there becomes this sort of reflex that you develop to being able to just get into a situation, deal with it, light it, shoot it, get it done, get it out, get the timing and get out again.
Yes.
And I think that once, I personally found once I started to kind of let go of worrying so much about all that stuff, it also became a lot easier. Like, it was sort of weird.
Yes.
It was, I'm keen to hear whether you've had the same reaction where, you know, the cameras, the lights, whatever, it doesn't really kind of matter. You're there and you're doing something and it just sort of kind of naturally flows.
Yeah, there is those days. I mean, you're forced into it. And in my situation, you know, even though, as we all know, as an assistant, you can be in the most intense situations and you do learn things.
Right.
And you learn things, what to do and what not to do. But then until it's on your shoulders and you have to direct a very, very, very intense situation, And then it becomes joy. Like, you know, I try to say, it sounds like a very sort of morbid, sort of cryptic, quick way. A camera in my hand and a subject in front of me is my joy, is my happiness.
Right.
And you have to enjoy it, and you must project that internally, even if you don't feel it. You must enjoy it. You know, there was a thing my dad said to me once. So funny how, like, you can learn from the masters, and you can learn from the people you work for, and you can learn from things you read and see, and then you learn from experiences, and then someone will say something one day, and you'll go, that's pretty perfect. You know, my dad and I are pretty close. I remember calling him up. I was really nervous. It was the first day going into the White House. I've been in there as photo assistants, but the first day I was there is under my own steam, and I was, you know, it's a pretty overwhelming feeling as a young photographer, the responsibility. And Dad just said, look, kid, you know, I'm really proud of you. I don't really understand the photo game, but I'm proud of you as a dad. I'll always be proud of you. He goes, well, can you just do me one thing? Even if you screw it up, I don't think you screw it up. Can you just have fun? Can you just say I'm in the White House and I'm having fun? I was like, that's just really shitty advice, but it wasn't, you know. It was pure, you know, the father really just saying, look, we're all proud of you, mate. It's not, you just got to go in there. But if you project that, and then obviously then there's so much more in terms of I've got humans in front of me who even if they're the most controlling, powerful people, it's your house, it's your home. You have to breathe it, live it, and give it. It has to come from you inside, regardless of the outcome. And, you know, yeah, so that was probably the pivotal moment where I went, well, let's just smile, put a smile on your face. And you can be terrified inside, but.
Right.
Have to try to let go with that.
So what was the, we'll sort of go back a little bit. What was the process from leaving Australia? Was it to go to work with Annie Leibovitz? Was that the initial aspect of going to New York originally?
Yes, I didn't go to photo school as a kid. I sort of didn't get into TAFE. I got knocked back to TAFE, which is community college here in Australia.
Right.
And then I worked for great photographers in Adelaide, really kind group of, you know, good people and great caring people like yourself in Sydney, and then some very intense photographers who gave me sort of my boot camp, Simon Harson and a few others who were
intense
and at sort of peak of their careers. And I was lucky as a 19-year-old kid, you just hang on and not get fired, basically. Mm. And then I was tired. I just thought I'd go as far as I could from Australia. And I thought had some bizarre thing. Goat herders or alpaca llama herds in South America seem pretty distant. So I got a book of tickets, and literally it was like a combined around the world ticket.
Yeah.
Like I'd even go and check into the airport, and the people at the airport would go, I've never seen this many stops on a ticket before. I had done so much research, and like, it was insane. There was like between two airlines and you could just go and go and go. And I spent a year in South America, and just slowed down, like just personally, just, it was, I just needed that to cleanse. And then I had gone to New York on the hope to get work there, but you don't know if you're going to get work. Young Australians can work in London. So I thought, well, I'll probably end up in London if I don't get an opportunity here. And, you know, you look back now and you just think pure naivety bordering on stupidity, and that you'll make these phone calls. And as you know, a friend of friend of friends, it's all community, it's all connections. You know, Sebastian Thor, who you know.
Yeah, right.
Was incredibly kind and you know, had a coffee with him, and he knew, you know, so basically Sebastian knew the studio manager, and he said, well, I'll give you, you know, I can put you in touch with him. And then I went in, and I mean, I can, yeah, it's quite the, you know, the interview process was hilarious. I just thought I was going to meet someone famous and I'd leave New York, and then it turned into meeting her assistants, and then her assistant said, you know, just fate is one thing. Like the assistant said, great, goodbye, see you. And I'm standing at the elevator about to leave, and then, you know, Martin came out, Martin Schuller, who's obviously a prominent photographer, and Martin's like, well, I didn't get to say good day to you, can you sit down? Oh, let's get Annie out. And then she asked me some questions about my portfolio, which I now looking back, I'm like, they're the stupidest answers in the world. How did you like that? Oh, I just light was floating around. What are you? And then, hey, can you intern on a Vanity Fair shoot next week?
Right.
And of course I'm like, oh, I have to check my schedule. Could be pretty busy. Yeah, right. You got nothing else to do. And then I got on there, and I remember showing up and she just looked at me. I showed up, you know, on a cold November morning in the streets photographing. I think it was Diane Lane or someone. And she's like, she just shook her head and went, Australians. And I'm like, I think I was in a t-shirt, you know, it was like minus 10 or something. She's like, and then she goes, next time you must buy the warmest outfit. And I went and spent every dollar I ever had at like some outrageous snow outfit, and I showed up in it. And she shook her head and went, "You stewardess don't get it, do you?" It's like, I don't know what that means, but I'll just keep working. So yeah, that was, there was no, I mean, we think we have a grand plan, but
right.
Sometimes there's fate and there's moments and there's opportunities, and you just, hopefully you don't, you know, you take when they come to you, and you get more of those than you get wrong, and you're okay. Yeah.
It, you know, it's, I think it's quite an Australian thing though. There's a sort of a tenacity to how we go about it. I found here with Americans and American assistants that so much sort of based on the education aspect of it. Let's go and get our degrees. Let's go and do this. And then they kind of get lost. They come out the other side of it, and yes, they have a brilliant sort of language of art and photography and ways of lighting, but they actually never had to really do it. You know, it's sort of, it's completely different. Whereas I think to go from, you know, Adelaide, Sydney, New York, people have no idea what that takes. Like, it literally is, you know, it's like another planet, really, in terms of sort of trying to get it going. So I can completely understand at this point, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's just a process of, but sometimes you don't realize the enormity of it if when you're a bit young and naive. You know, like,
yeah,
we think of some of those, and I know we make these people into cartoon characters, and they're not. It's a lot more complicated than that, but the Gallipoli stuff, some of those young men who went off,
right.
You know, I've been to Gallipoli and read those letters in that. It's the most heartbreaking letters you're ever going to read of these young men who thought they were getting a free trip to Europe, you know, and they surely weren't. And some of the naivety of they were going to have a good time, and it's clearly not the same as that. But sometimes when you just don't understand the ramifications, but also the fact of, you know, I'd walk in there and there was literally a Canadian, two Germans, I think there was a Swede, and looked around. I'm like, there's no Americans here. And I'm like, because she's smart enough to know that they can't run home to mum when it's a bad day.
When it gets tough,
And, you know, so I worked for her for a year. And then, so I replaced a first assistant, Julian Defort, who was a real great, actually really talented photographer. Just physically, he had a car accident. He was in a taxi accident, and I sort of stepped in, and she wanted me to be the first assistant immediately, which was far above my abilities at that point. So I settled into sort of being part of the team, and then Julian came back. But then, and it sort of was heartbroken that I was sort of bounce out as in terms of a consistent member and maybe be freelance. But then I went and worked for this amazing list of people who I really deeply respected, like Mark Salliger, a lot on the road with Mark.
Right.
And you know, what a machine. Mary Ellen Mark, you know, on a hero.
Right. Yeah.
And then I got to work a lot with Martin Schuller as he was coming up with the New Yorker and all the big head stuff. Like, we developed all that stuff. But then I got to work with Harry Benson, who people don't know as well as the rest of the world. And to work with Harry Benson, who came across the Beatles, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, number one. And there is no one that Harry had, and to get in a car and get on the road with Harry, you know, to go further off the bushes, and then, Christopher Reeve and these projects, and Christopher Reeve just to spend time with these legends as a kid, just the gratitude to listen, you know, and ask stupid questions. And Harry's like, "That's a stupid question. Why would you ask such a stupid question?" You go, "But I'll answer it because you're a good kid."
But what a brilliant education. I mean, you know,
blessed.
Yeah, you can't. And that's a little bit of what I'd hope with the Photorian, and this is the sort of the aspect of the idea, is that the stories are the most important part. And I think you get really good talent and good people together, and let's hear what it took, or how they got there, or what they did, and because there's a lot in it that you can't learn. It's just not, you can't go to school and learn that stuff. You know, right? It just doesn't exist.
No, you've just got to have your wits about you and just try to keep thinking. You can't keep, because there's no grand plan. You know, I've got parents who are incredibly kind and open, and as long as their kid's doing something that they're working hard at and supporting, they'll support it. But it didn't understand, you know, the context of what the industry took. So you just got to find your own way. And as long as you're waking up doing the best you can, and, you know, we all make mistakes along the way. You just got to minimize those. So, yeah, it's just definitely, it's been a journey. There's some stories.
No, it certainly has.
Settle in. Get a good coffee.
So after assisting and obviously building up a really good sort of ability to sort of think, okay, I can do this on my own. Was there a breakthrough commission that occurred? Was there someone that hired you off the cuff and said, go and try this? And
yeah, there's a few editors. It's like, this is the benefit of working for those people is there's a little network of people who are the most, impressive people. So you get to say, look, I'm taking pictures. Can I show you pictures? And you come in. And I remember getting a really early break at Newsweek, and I actually got to shoot some early covers, not the big portrait stuff, but some of the science stories. And because they're weekly magazines, the volume coming at you is so high. Yeah. And you don't get time to really the thing that's bad about that is you don't get time to craft it, but you don't get time to sit on it and worry about it. You do it and there's a volume. I remember going into the Newsweek photo director's office, and he looked at me and he goes, I know what you're thinking. He goes, I know you're a bit confused. Why did I give you a cover at this age in your career and how you see my experience? He goes, but let me just put it this way. He goes, I know that you've worked for all the legends. So I know you'll get on the plane. I know you'll get off the plane. I know you'll get to the location. I know you'll do the best you can. I don't know how talented you are. I haven't figured that out yet. But I know you're not going to screw it up. And I can't afford to screw up in this job. So don't, kid, I know you're not going to screw it up. We're going to find out how talented you are, you know?
Right.
And things like that. And like Chris Doherty in New York Magazine, who's gone through, he was at New York at the time and then he's gone on sort of Time Inc. and all sorts of things. But Chris, remember early on, I said I was scouting. Someone's shot in Ellis Island and I kept wanting to be what he wanted me to be. And he said this beautiful thing. He goes, I didn't hire you to do what I want you to do. I hired you to be you. So just go and be you, mate. You know? Just go and take pictures that mean something to you. And I guarantee you they'll succeed, you know? Like, just gratitude on those that level for kind, kind that those editors gave you a chance and a break because they got mortgages and kids and houses and obviously their job is to find new talent and to discover and to support and to nurture. But, sometimes you look back and you're like, oh, that was very kind of them and always grateful. So,
all those amazing portraits you've had to do, especially a lot of the ones for Newsweek and a lot of the political stuff, you've had to work under, quite tremendous pressure. And so I wonder, can you talk about how that process evolved over the years? Was it initially a sort of a shock and then suddenly you're like, okay, I can make this work and I'm going to do it this way?
Yes. It's clearly an evolution. No one can walk into those rooms. No one walks into those rooms knowing no one can. It's not a normal environment. It's just not normal in any way. And like, there's been plenty of sleepless nights and there's been plenty of situations where I've not failed catastrophically, but not gotten the most out of it because I wasn't aggressive enough or I was too kind or I was all the other way around. But I did get to work. I got to see Mark Seliger work under pressure. I've never seen anyone like to work, to see any Harry, Mary Ellen, to see those people handle those subjects, whether I could take a good picture or not is irrelevant. Who knew until you put a camera in your hand, but to watch them deal with those people and how they react or how they didn't react.
Right.
That is gold. And if you're paying attention as an assistant, I mean, there's only so much you can learn. At the end of the day, a computer's a computer. A camera is just a box that has things in light going through a lens, and whether it records onto silver halides or some digital ones and twos, it's irrelevant. Just a thing. How you manage the talent in front of you or the people in the worst situations. How's your natural reaction to react and then pull yourself back and say, hang on, no, that's not going to meet the objective. Right. So I'm so grateful that those environments taught me what to do, what not to do. Mm. And I slowly, but naturally, editors would give you small shoots. So you would get given, the best doctors for New York Magazine or Newsweek could say, go off and photograph the school teacher of the year, Right. And then you just put yourself, and also too, at some point, it's like the good shoots, a quick shoot's a good shoot. Not that I would, there's only so long, if you're only going to get, I think you're going to get the best out of someone in a fairly short period of time. Like, I don't know what to do with myself after 30 minutes. I'm like, kind of used to it. What am I doing here? And it's not because I want to go home for lunch, but there's only so much. There's a moment that we share. There's a fleeting moment as a photographer and a subject. And yes, some are faster and slower, but you build into that. So to answer your question, it was probably an evolution over time. Grateful that editors gave me not the biggest day first. I get scared of young photographers getting a break too early. Like the editors now have woken up to the fact that they've failed at hiring people of color, of different gender, or different sexuality. And that's, I think they're pushing back a little too aggressively right now, but it's a good thing. It's a necessary thing. So sorry if that's background noise here in Australia. But in terms of the evolution to try to get to that point, you hope that you're guided along the path to give yourself an opportunity to grow into that. And I was.
Yeah, right. So that's, you know, I find that interesting for lots of reasons, especially with the sort of opportunities that you were given, that you were allowed to then, you know, there's that picture that you have on your website of you showing Bono how to, I think, pose in a particular picture.
Yeah. And really me showing a rock star how to move.
Exactly. And you know, big U2 fan, so I'm like, that's a, you know, that's a super cool picture. I thought, he's actually showing Bono how to do it. But then are those things for you, are those quite organic things, or do you ever go into a shoot and sort of plan it the night before, or do a quick sketch and say, you know what, maybe I'll, you know, this is what I want to do? Or are you literally just happy to roll up and work within the framework?
It's a big, big combination. You know, yeah. I have a huge photographic book library.
Right.
That is really essential in terms of research. And so it's like everything. You've got to know your homework very, 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 very well. And that doesn't have to come from just photo books. It can come from the New York Times. It can come from, you know, random snaps that you see around the place. So yes, I do a stack of homework, knowing that there's got to be a plan. But you've got to be open to happy accidents. You've got to be. It's weird. You've got to be a control freak, but you've got to let the control go at a certain point. And I learned early on that if you let them, there's actually a really interesting conversation about Bono and computer screens and control. Lots to share in terms of the ability, because. You've got to go in with a very clear plan, a very clear strategy, but you've got to be willing to let it go. And sometimes the best things is when they push back on you, like there's a story with Ralph Lauren, like you want something and they won't give it to you. And then they're also interesting people, so let them offer. They may offer you something that you had never thought of or you never believe. Like you don't know. So you can sometimes push it back on them. And this is why photographing politicians or powerful people, they actually want to, it's really weird, they like to make a deal. So sometimes I'd be in these situations where we would be making a deal.
Right.
And I'm like, this is strange, make a deal, you know. Okay, no, Ralph, I know you've got a helicopter leaving from your pad now to the Hamptons. I want to get in the helicopter with you. And he looks at you like, it's not going to happen, kid. And I'm like, well, that's really sad. I promised the magazine to get a helicopter. He's looking like, don't promise that. I go, what else can we do today? You know, and then he's like, oh, let's go play basketball. Let's go shoot hoops, you know?
Right.
So even though that doesn't seem, it was actually more powerful in a human connected way. Him sitting in a helicopter is kind of expected maybe. But like that story with Bono, like there was this story about computers and digital. I knew he was a control freak. So we took every screen out of the studio and my camera, I had this setting on the camera, you know, it's 5D or what it was at the time, irrelevant. Right. But I made the review of the image, the result as tiny as the thing can be. I said, "Is this how small a screen can we make it?" And we made it down to like 1 centimeter. And I knew he was a control freak. So the minute we took a picture, he looked around like, "Where's the screen? Where's the screen?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, yeah. We haven't got one today. It's coming. I guess we haven't got it yet. It's sort of on the way. It was just a load of shit." And then he goes, "Show me the camera. Show me the camera." And then I showed him the back on the camera. And sure enough, so this is the ability to sort of think forward and see what someone's going to checkmate you. And he looked at me, he goes, "Can it go bigger?" I'm like, "Yeah, no, this camera doesn't go bigger. No, this one doesn't, you know?" And he looked at me, he's like, "Oh," because I just knew that whatever I showed him, he would say, "That's shit," or not that shit, "That's not what I want," because I want to be a controlling character.
Yeah, right.
I deal with those people all the time. So you've got to play this. I don't like confrontation. I don't like conflict. No one wants, that is never the place to have conflict.
Right.
But you've got to learn to control the situation, the environment, them. It's really, it's like this, like multiple brains going at once. It's like sometimes I've even had like a.
You mean conversation with yourself?
Sometimes it can feel like a third person out of body experience.
Right.
Because you have this moment where you're like, photographers have like multiple brains. I think it's really interesting because you've got this technical brain spinning. You've got this emotional brain spinning.
Right.
You've got a logistical brain spinning.
Right.
Like many times photo assistants say to me, "Okay, we're going to go here to here to here to here." And I tell the subject, "We're doing 2 shots. You know, I've got 10 shots lined up." And my sister's like, "Why would you take them from here to here? Because it makes sense to move a light from A to B." I'm like, "Yeah, but that's going to mess. That's going to take them out of the moment and they're going to walk away." So we're going to keep, like even things like I would do quite often do a headshot first. I do a close-up picture very early on in a shoot. I would never do a pulled back environmental shot first, even though if the the communications person say, well, that's the best one to do, or the editor would say to me, but that's the cover. The cover isn't a headshot. The cover is that, what if he walks after it? If I can get him in a corner with a foam core around me or just wherever I am, I can connect on a human scale. It's not about the headshot.
Yeah,
it's about right. It's about this,
yeah.
About the eye contact, the humanity. And also like the opening line you say is really important. You know, we all know the Richard Avedon story about killing the dogs, which, yeah. You know, it's probably the most human way of the story, you know, or the church, you know, the Churchill cigar stuff. But the ability to say something human connected, you know, like, I'm not going to talk about politics in the White House with these guys. I want to talk about sports, or what are they into food?
Yeah,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
You know, like I remember the first thing I said to Obama was, I mean, there's many different situations we can sort of break down some of those moments, but like his family, sports, music, we all are deeply human on some point. We all connect right. on the same things in so many ways. So mm-hmm. find those places and build from there. You know?
Yeah. No, that's really interesting because I guess looking at the especially the presidential portraits that you've done, there's some of those black and white ones are just astoundingly beautiful. And of course, you get quite shocked when you see the Trump one within it, because it seems, because there's actually another picture you took of Donald Trump. Was it in his apartment, maybe, where he's sort of very Arnold Newman like, the wide angle lens. He's sitting there.
Yeah,
with
that is Newman. Like, yeah,
right,
that's Newman.
Newman, right? I thought that might have been in that, and it's just genius. I mean, it's just, it says so much about you know, and to me, you'd obviously thought about that, like that. In that photographer brain where all those different things are going on, you saw that image exactly as you kind of wanted to and sort of played into it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Walk him over here. And, you know, the whole time I think, you know, he's such a we have a special series of podcasts and a psychology podcast when you get to that one, Greg. But no, he, yes. You are going through those moments and, you know, like, I came close to the Arnold Newman picture of Robert Moses, you know, the commissioner of New York, on that pile on that beam over on Roosevelt Island, looking back over the UN.
I was like, right.
The outrageousness of that image and the power of that image, you know, or Heroes pictures, the Rolling Stone, you know, that album cover.
It's just like a brilliant picture.
I remember being an assistant in Seliger's studio, and I'm upstairs at the assistant's desk. And I'm staring at this album cover because I folded it out. You know, it's a CD open.
Yeah.
And that head series. And I'm trying to figure it out. And Mark walked over and I didn't know he was there. And he looked at me and goes, yeah, we've all looked at that. We've all looked at that in awe. Keep looking at it, kid. Keep looking at it. And I'm like, yeah, we are. So, you know, that, you know, that's the love of who we do and those people who've come before us. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's, yeah. Especially Hero. I mean, he's a particular, because he has,
yes.
You know, for me, you know, there's the still life portrait thing there, you know, combined and beauty. And it's just, his pictures just blow me away every single time, you know. And I love that he was an Avedon assistant, but then he doesn't look like Avedon at all, you know. So that's what's so sort of brilliant in how that played. So.
Hero also took that one picture. It's weird. It's almost like I'm a human portrait photographer, but almost my most, I'm pretty sure it's Hero photographed the spacesuits, the NASA spacesuits on Iraq.
Yeah, he did.
That picture is astonishing. The power in that picture is heartbreakingly astonishing.
Yeah.
Something about that. Maybe it's the boy inside of us, the spirit of the astronaut, you know, so I don't know.
You know, there's a lot of photo sort of, journalism in what you do and the way you've had to go out. How have then, when you've then, you know, had to sort of flip to the other side, when someone's come to want you to shoot an ad, you know, to do an advertising job,
yes,
that is based upon that work? Because that becomes a lot more complicated, right? Because you're sort of watering down all what you,
Yeah, you're in a hiding to nothing in many ways.
Right.
It's tricky because quite often they're inspired and they fall in love with these images of these powerful, you know, a human connect. My hope is I take a human connected portrait of someone who's usually portrayed as non-human and non-connected. That's the goal. Yeah. And I don't always succeed. And sometimes I do. And sometimes I get closer than other days. And then people come to you with, hey, you know, we've got the board of directors or this corporation or this ad campaign. Can you do it? And I've had big wins and I've had some big losses, not big losses, but I can see the client go, like I've even said to people around me, agents and producers, I'm like, you never want to go into a deal. over, you know, you're meant to under promise, overwhelm. You're meant to, what's the combo?
Yeah, yeah.
And I, mine starts all, and mine's so flipped the other way because they're like, oh, look at Barack, you know, he's the greatest.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, oh, I'm in trouble here, you know? So, so there's that, like, I've photographed some executives and they're like, thanks, Ben, it's great. It just doesn't feel like the same sense of power. I'm like, it's tricky, but then there's been some big wins because there'll be moments where, you know, like I did a rebranding of a financial company after the, you know, stock exchange or after the financial crash.
Right.
And they wanted to get across the humanity of the everyday person, these financial planners who are your soccer coach and your, you know, they're your auntie and your uncle. So I photograph a lot of times real people quite often because how do you translate that works? No one, like, presidents don't do campaigns for watches as much as the current the former occupant would love to do all those campaigns.
Love sponsored by Rolex.
Everything, which he kind of has done anyway.
Yeah, right.
Even when he's been told he couldn't. So I photograph real people, and that I find a joy. But then again, it has trained me incredibly well. Like photographing board of directors. Like I've been up near your neck of the woods many times, photographing boards of corporate boards. Like, you know. Before GE moved, like I can deal with those boards. I can deal with. I've actually had so many times PR people go, "Oh, that was the easiest," but they're going to walk away in 2 minutes. I go, "Yeah, I know. Trust me, we're all good. We can do this." And it's not an arrogant thing. It's just experiencing at this point where I go, "Gotcha." You know, I can. Those big group shots under pressure where you've got big egos trying to run the show. Yeah, I gotcha. You know, but you've also got to bring in, there's so many tricks to that about how, I mean, I can break down the tricks of group, big, successful, powerful group shots. Right. And there is like this basic, remember Annie said one thing, she goes, all I am is just a glorified removalist. I just move furniture all day.
Yeah.
And if I get the furniture right, I get the rest right. I'm like, that's a weird thing to say. And you know, literally, there's two things about shooting those powerful groups. You put tape on the ground, which has left foot, right foot, so you get that body angle right. And you figure out two people. Who's the most perfect, powerful person in the room?
Mm-hmm.
You get them doing what you want to do first, and the rest will follow. And then there's someone in that group who will joke with you. There's someone who you can have a crack. You can have a crack at. You can make. Yeah. You're like, you know, there's always some guy with a tie that's weird. And you're like, did you really pick that tie out? I don't know about that. Did your wife pick that out? He goes, yeah, the wife picked it out. You know, and everyone like, and all the people look amazing. I'm like, Joe, what's up with your tie again? You know, like, but that's humanity, right? We're going to break it down, but it's also a controlling game, you know?
Do you ever find in those big group shots that you've got someone who just is not happy with the place that they've been given and the position? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
They've got to suck it up, buttercup, at some point. You know, at some point you can't make everyone happy. I remember being on one of the first big shoot with Annie. It was like one of it was a fold-out Vanity Fair cover.
Right.
And it was Joaquin Phoenix who was put on the ground. And he was furious about it. He was just like playing, like, to the point that he wanted just like, I was like, is he going to, he wanted cigarette. Then he wanted Tom Selleck hair stuck on his chest. And then he was just like torturing everyone. It was just hilarious watching this back and forth. But you get that. But you got to like play him off a little bit and just like, you know, it's a game. You got to smile. You got to be willing to, because you got to be willing to play. It's risk too. You got to stick your neck out and be like, ooh, that's not the right person to say it to.
Yeah.
Well, that is. But that's the ability. But that's also your job. Your job isn't just to let them walk in a room and be the photographer. My job is to get to them before. Or if I'm photographing someone and I'll say, can I come up to your headquarters and just take a walk around the offices? I don't really need to meet them. But I can walk into someone's, we all can, walk into some office. If I'm photographing a powerful person, I just get a look in their room. Whatever is on their shelf tells you, you know, the Kaiser Soze stuff, you know, it's different, but you can see, you can learn, you can tell a portrait of someone by what's on there, the tchotchkes or the pictures or what's not on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, and you can very quickly find out a lot about someone without, and then you've got to go in there and go get in there, meet them, connect with them. You've also, I also learned early on as a photographer that you've got to reassure them very early that you're serious about your job, you know, especially as a young photographer, you had to very much portray that this is not my first rodeo, to the point that I would actually quite often, this is really interesting, we live in this age of high-tech gadgetry, and I used to bring other pictures of other people to prove to them that I am good and to get 5 more minutes out of them, and that progressively became like with Bono, like when Bono walked in and I wanted a portrait of Bono, I knew his PR person was a nightmare and she wouldn't let me do it, and it was because it was a group shot of the Red Group, which that red group that does all the fundraising. And when I showed Bono pictures of secretaries of state, presidents, another heads of state. And I said, I need a picture of you for this. And then he, you know, he saw him. Oh, when are you going to show Bono other rock stars? He doesn't care about other rock stars.
Yeah, right.
You know, that can't impress him. So you got to, but even like to the point when we're photographing Carlos Slim in Mexico City, you know, richest man in the world, cover of Forbes, you know, I'm the most powerful one. And it's just like bring in pictures of pieces. Literally, you're better off bringing, actually, this is good advice to anyone listening if you're trying to get, like, to get someone's confidence. Don't bring your pictures on an iPad. No one knows, no one wants to touch an iPad. No one,
yeah,
they get freaked out with that disconnect of technology. Literally, on your Canon desktop printer, print out a bunch of paper crap, bring it in there and go, look, a photo of him, photo of him, photo of him, photo of her. And it's so weird. Some people are like, I've had people like, well, good for you. Or some people are like, hmm. And then what goes from a 2-minute shoot goes to a 20-minute shoot to like, hey, can I get in the car with you? Are you going to have lunch with the king today? Can I get in the car with you? Like,
right.
I've said this before. I've said this to people, like, as a magazine editors can only get you in the door.
Right.
They only get you in the house. Your job is to go further. The pressure on you is not to give them the picture they asked for, is to give them the picture they asked for and something else they didn't see coming.
That's the
breakthrough. You know, like going to Omaha and photographing Warren Buffett. Like they asked for a portrait of Warren Buffett on gray. They didn't ask for a picture of Warren Buffett drinking, you know, $2 milk sundaes at his favorite diner with a mirror ball in the background. But that picture came off the back of us paying attention. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I went into, he was having lunch with his students and I'm watching and I'm like, oh my God, that's the moment of humanity right there. He's eating chocolate sundaes at 12 o'clock in Omaha. And then we're saying to Warren, I need that picture. I need that picture. He's walking out. It's like, gotta be quick, kid. Gotta be quick. It's like, I'm quick. And I go, yeah. He goes, only one condition. You're paying for the sundae. I'm like, the richest man in the world. Like, you're paying for the sundae. I'm like, $275. I got the $275 covered, sir. You know, but that's the thing. Cause then that moment of coming back to the magazine or the advertising client or whoever it is, and you put that on the desk and they go, I mean, you got to get the safe shot or in the bag, the formula. Right. And then they go, Ooh, there's the fun, you know, and that's the joy, right? That's the chase for me.
Right. And that's, you know, that when I look at your work and reviewed your work, I can see those moments of brilliance where you've taken it and gone on. And it's really complicated to do. It takes a lot of guts, I think, to be able to, maybe it's an Australian thing. Maybe it's an ex-AFL boy or something, but I think it takes a lot to be able to push yourself into those situations without being sort of too pushy because you've been surrounded by these PRs and all these people who are trying to control their client and control what you do and how good they're going to look. So that's impressive to be able to do that.
Thanks, mate. It's a game, but it's a bit of a game. It's really weird. Like, you got to take it serious. It's a very, very, very – like Harry Benson would say to me, this is a very serious business.
Right.
It's an insanely serious business. So if you see me joking with that person, I might be joking with them, but I'm not joking with them. So stay out of it. You know, right. I mean, some of these moments of like, remember he said to me once this thing, which is the most amazing thing. I'm standing there in a suit and tie and something goes, hey, kid, when I'm talking about bananas with the subject, I'm talking about bananas. But you know what? I'm not talking about bananas. I might be talking about bananas, but I'm not really talking about bananas. So don't come in and talk about bananas. I'm just saying bananas. All right. And I'm like, and I'm looking at him like, just say yes and don't come in, you know?
Right.
It was this game. Like, he's like, I just watched, he was legendary at it. But it's a game and you've got to, you know, because I think also too, the pictures that, the reason why the unexpected moments come from moments that you've got to try to, and ever increasingly find them in the most controlled environment. Like, when I would go into and photograph, you know, I wish John Kennedy, JFK, I mean, obviously JFK is really important for the presidency, but had such a pivotal presidency who knew the power of cameras and photographers. He knew, like, apparently these amazing stories of JFK would bring photographers along and Jackie would be pissed off. She's like, I don't want them anywhere near me. He goes, no, trust me. The power of these images is everything.
Yeah.
He knew the craft. But the difference between being a photographer now and being a photographer then, I remember saying to Harry, you know, when you went and did this portrait of Elizabeth Taylor, how did you get that shot? And he goes, hey, kid, I went to Africa for a month. You know, they sent me off for 3 weeks.
God,
you know, he goes, just go and spend a month, go spend a week, go spend. And now, like, I literally get on a plane and go to Chicago and walk into a room and they go, and then they'll say, hey, you know, when you photograph this person in Chicago, here's all the most powerful, here's the most interesting pictures of people who are the most exciting, you know, Elon Musk type. Like, here, or even just like the obvious stuff. Here are the greatest presidential moments in history. by the way, can you go in at 2:05 to 2:09? And he's in the room. There's going to be 20 people watching you, and they're going to kick you out. Give me one of those, mate. And you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'm literally on hiding to nothing. Like, well, no. Like, but you've got to find a way. It's really a,
right. So, did you suffer any burnout because of working at that sort of pace and level?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. Massive burnout. Yeah. My dad came to New York once, and he went, "Hey, kid, I'm really impressed with you." He goes, "You can't keep this up. Yeah. You physically can't keep this up. I don't think you can. I just don't think it's going to." And sure enough, you know, I'd gone and got myself a studio in Chelsea and got myself employees and thought I was all big and fancy and mighty. I remember walking down Park Avenue. I bought like a sandwich I was going to eat in 3 minutes so I can get to this and this and this and this. And then my arm was shaking, and I'm like, "Why is my arm shaking?" And I had some really crazy things happen in personal life with someone close to me dying and a fire in an apartment and all these like things hit at once. And I'm like, "What's going on?" And I was like, "And am I breathing?" I said to my friend, I said, "I'm breathing really fast." He goes, "That's called anxiety. It's like a panic attack or something."
Yeah, I'm
like,
exactly.
"Really? Is that what that is?" And then it was just literally the world saying, "You can't," like the world, what my dad had said to me 4 years later came true. He's like, you can't work that hard. Yeah. And so that was important, and I'm lucky that I had good people around me to sort of say it's okay, and I had a bit of a buffer financially to enable myself to try to – I didn't want that to happen. I wasn't happy about it, but to learn. And also two things, like remember one photographer said to me early on, he goes, "Hey, mate, just remember, you're not going to win every day. You're not going to win. So when you would build so much into the – because I don't control the I don't control much at all. Like I don't control the time. I don't control the place. I don't control the attitude. I don't control – these people have – but busy lives, you don't know what's happening before your shoot. You don't know. There's so much out of your control that if you don't win some days, don't beat yourself up. Like, be kind to yourself. I mean, if you were lazy and you didn't prepare and you failed, well, it's on you.
Right.
But if you've done everything you can do and you didn't win, don't beat yourself up. Don't hurt yourself.
Right.
You know, because it's going to – just be kind, go to bed, sleep, wake, you know. I mean, I think – you know, I'm not a parent. I imagine as a parent, it gives you a greater grounding of understanding what counts or what doesn't count, you know.
That level of stress after a long period of time, I find builds up and up and up and up and up. And, you know, you must have had those moments where you know, because those very high pressure situations that you were placed in.
Yeah, and you've got to learn. I had a really important moment. I think this is an important thing to say to other people who are desperate to be successful and want to succeed, and it's really honorable and really you should have that power and burning ambition and intensity. I'm photographing a woman one day, and she said to me, she goes, she was a bank executive. It wasn't like some, you know, some sort of successful woman. She's been photographing for a magazine. And, "What's your hobbies, Ben?" And I went, she goes, "Oh, collecting photography books isn't one of them." I'm like, "Going to photo exhibitions? Nope. Can you name something in outside of photography that is your hobby?" And I went, no, I couldn't answer that. And I was like, that's pathetic. And she goes, "Well, good thing to think about," or something. And I went, you know, it's good advice, you know. And that time I'm living downtown Manhattan, and you know, coming from Australia, it's an island, and I've only ever lived on islands. It's really crazy between Manhattan and Australia. I've only ever lived on islands. You're on Long Island. Yeah, you can pull that off too. So then I went, hang on. And I remember like my uncle had a sailboat here in Sydney and he lives in North Coast and everything. And I went, screw this. So I joined the little Manhattan Sailing Club down in Battery Park. And that changed my outlook and balance and happiness because I just learned to do a little sailing in the little J26s and 24s.
Yeah, fantastic.
You know, dodging the Staten Island Ferry and sailing in front of the Statue of Liberty, which never gets old. That's outrageous. Like, to be zipping around there. And that became my refuge and my way of understanding, connected. It was like, because you get on the boat and everyone's like, they're all from different walks of life. They're all from random backgrounds and they just care about, and no one cared about your photography. And they sort of, maybe they go, "Oh, that's a pretty interesting story. It's not a normal day."
Right.
Yeah, I know, mate. But, you know, but they would like care and not care, you know. It's like,
good
for you, you know, like, but well, that's all, you got to make sure we get this boat out there and get it back and not kill ourselves. So, and it was just that saved me from becoming that was really critically important. And I'll continue to do that.
That's fascinating because I remember seeing I guess, social media stuff of you sailing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and I was trying to think back. I thought I couldn't remember whether you'd been a sailor in Australia, you know, because Australia's are known for sailors. You know, it's sort of us and the Kiwis are kind of, you know, have that sewn up. And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. But then I remember thinking at the time, that's just the ultimate outlet. You know, you've just got to, you know, get away
and
decompress in a whole other way. Right.
Yeah. And also being in New York, you don't realize, like, I went and did three or four trips down to the Caribbean. I mean, I did sail the British Virgin Islands, the Grenadines. Wow. I got to do a sailing trip in the Grenadines and only the Antipodeans or the Brits. And I got to go to a one-day cricket game in St. Vincent with Australia versus the West Indies at the Windies 1-1 run. And I was a guest of honor at a TV executive's place. And then I went in the stand with the steel drums and the drum and bass. It was the greatest day of sports in my life. And we lost. And I didn't care. I was just like, you, pure happiness. The joy that came from that day was like, so good. Can't. How magical that day was. And that's through, again, sailing. Like, just, you know, I was actually really, it was like, again, I had hit the wall in a lot of areas in New York, and I went down to the Caribbean and I jumped, you know, and we're on a six of us. It was a learning trip.
Right.
And, you know, it's so funny because I showed up and these people, they'd done their homework and they're like, oh, we've got a professional photographer showing up. He's going to document the whole trip. And I think I showed up with an iPhone 4 or something. And they're like, that's it? And I go, yeah, I'm not here for that. So, I look back now, I wish I brought up my gear, but
yeah, it wasn't for that. There must have been some amazing opportunities.
No, right? Just waking up and, you know, they're like, you can sleep in that bunk. I was like, no, I'm sleeping on the deck. I slept in the sail one night. That was great. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. It's a good segue from in sport. I love the AFL series you did for our American listeners. There's not there's Australian rules football, and I wondered how that came about, because I mean, you know, when you're a homesick expat and you see someone photographing footy teams, you're going to look at those pictures. You're just straight away going to be totally enthralled by them. So was that sort of, I'm not sure how that came about. So could you talk about that?
Yeah. It's a really beautiful, powerful. Yeah. So I grew up a kid from Adelaide, Australia, and my dad, of course, he was a Collingwood fan as a young boy. He grew up in Paran, Victoria.
Did he really?
Wow. You know, he's a Paran boy. Yeah. He knows his stuff really well. So like Kevin Sheedy and he were in the same age group growing up and like knocking around, and he was a good footballer, but didn't break through to that kind of levels. Anyway, he moved to South Australia and they bought a house across the ground from Albert and Oval, which is Port Adelaide. And it's a very old club. It's 150 years old, has great tradition. So my youth literally was, I learned to run around the professional oval. I grew up like, it's like equivalent in my town to Yankee Stadium or, you know, Dodger Stadium or, you know, Lambeau Field or whatever, right? So it's a community football club, and the neighborhood was, you know, it's a fairly working class, dock land, poor, you know, so the sporting team success is everything. And so it became my humanity. And then there's a really successful art director here who we've just lost a while ago. It's really sad. But Jeff Robinson was this art director who pro bono was working for the club because he loved him too. And he did this amazing moment where he's got Koshy and the whole board sitting up in the executive suite. And people at the club knew who I was, sort of. They're like some kid had left, you know, like some kids from there, like, and they did this executive thing. We showed his pictures. Hey, I got an idea for the guy who's going to shoot your next national campaign or your campaign for membership. And then they show all these presidential stuff. And then they go, hey, guys, can you look out the window? See the car park? And they're like, yeah. But that's where the kid grew up. So my dad, for those who are not have not seen the movie The Castle,
right?
It's a famous Australian movie about a man who lives next to an airport. Cool. Yeah. It's his palace. Like every home is his palace.
Right.
Our home was our precious growing up childhood home, eventually was purchased by the club and bulldozed and turned into a car park.
Oh my God,
my dad couldn't be more proud of that car park. He loves that car park. He takes me there and he's like, let's go and stand in the sand pit. Look, that's what your swing was. I'm like, Dad, they smashed the house down. I know, isn't it great? But the club did it. You know? So the point of the project was that let's get a kid who knows us, who knows, you know, it's a person who loves it. So it was basically just a celebration of the people.
Right.
So it was literally one of the greatest days of my life. Like I literally got to be in the grandstand where all the old premiership teams would hang around And I, of course, I made sure Dad had to be there as my on-set coffee guy or something.
Yeah, of course.
And I just, my brother, my dad, and just to be able, like, this is the thing about photography. Who said it once? A few photographers will say it over the years. It is one of the greatest lower paid jobs in the history of the world. It is the moments it will give you the joy of sharing these. It gives you the chance to share experience.
Yeah.
Yes, 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 you have to. It was this. I went to this photo weekend in the Barossa Valley, a wine region in Australia. Right. And this is Melbourne photographer. I forget his name. He's a legendary old guy. Not Goings, another guy. And he was doing these group portraits. And I was 18 years old. And I'm like, I want to get a print from that. He goes, kid, I'm not giving you a print from this. And he would like get groups of people together, and he would like art direct them and like, you go over here, you go here. I'm like, I said, look, I'll come to your darkroom in Melbourne. I'll print them. He goes, no. And finally, he goes, kid, you don't understand it. I don't put film in a camera, so leave me alone. I'm like, huh? He spent a weekend photographing people with no film in the camera. He just loved the act of making people do things. He loved the shared. He just make like the joy of creating was the joy.
Right.
So it's not that the conversation is not, hey, I get to hang out with famous people. That's not the point. I couldn't care.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that's the part of the job, but it's that shared experience to be able to say to a client, if I lose the cameras and the digital files, I'm still happy.
Yeah.
You can't say that to your client. They're like, well, you'll never work again. I never would work again. You know, like, don't even call us. But if you can make the most of the shared experience, then that is, I treasure that moment. I could treasure that shared connection between us. And as a result, if you focus on that, the result should be good, should be better than good. It should be great.
Right.
But that's the joy. So at least you get that. At least you walk away from that experience with that day in your own life to have learned something. You know, it's that little university of life stuff on a sort of juiced up level.
So I was interested whether you have worked on. I mean, I know your work has been shown in galleries and stuff, but have you done any solo shows? Have you sort of decided to do something that would be just your a project or your work?
Not yet. I haven't really gotten to that point, which is I had the most close I come to that. I've had a shared group show at the National Portrait Gallery here, which was important. Right. And I shared an exhibition at the National Geographic Museum in DC with Mark Peterson, mm-hmm. who he and I are at Redux pictures together. And Mark's really, everyone look up Mark Peterson. He's got a book coming out called White Noise.
Right.
He won the Eugene Smith grant, which, you know, Eugene Smith did that great.
Yep.
Was it Pittsburgh project? And Mark did this incredible book that's come out, and Mark spent the last year and a half with white supremacists in America. And Mark was, there's that Officer Goodman who bravely led the insurrectionists away from the Senate chambers. Mark was in that, Mark was running over that person's shoulder. Mark was in the middle of that pack.
Wow.
Mark has never, like, he's the most incredible. He lives in New Jersey. Sweet guy, hardest working man in show business. But Mark, like those kind of photos, he and I have this political exhibition that we couldn't have taken more different pictures, more varied. Like, but he was like, it was just a real treat to have his reportage stuff like on the campaign trail with these like crazy, with these intense moments. And then there's this like kind of, you know, it was just after Trump got elected, and it was this bizarre energy in New York, in DC and around the world. Yeah, really intense process of sharing it. So it was great to share with him, but no, I'm keen for coming back here, and it's a little slower, and I am thinking about, I've been writing stories about, I've been writing book, I'm trying to write together a collected series of stories about being behind the camera.
Fantastic.
You know, I'm reading biographies of photographers who, you know, some of those stories. I remember one of the greatest things is go and read like a Life magazine book of what those photographers saw. Like, you know, those books have been around for 50 years, but the Magnum guys or the Life guys, and just listen to what those guys had to go through. We know the iconic ones, and D-Day and those stories, but, you know, and even the Tim Hetherington story, which is heartbreaking and sad. And those sort of heroes, the journey that they've taken to do personal work that was powerful to them. So there are other stories are out there. So yeah, trying to get to that point of sharing those experiences, because it's not normal. Like, I've done given some talks here to business groups and to people, and like what we consider a normal day is not a normal day. Not a normal day. Right. We have to normalize it because we have to succeed.
Yeah.
But we have to normalize it because we have to succeed. But it's not normal and it's an important thing. You know, it's like, yeah, like, you know, just things like, yeah, I mean, endless stories. Like, you know, maybe you shouldn't smack Suge Knight in the face. It was an accident because the photo care was like, you shouldn't wear the wrong gang colors to the wrong shoot. Like, hey, Ben, shouldn't wear it. Why did you wear red jacket? Like, get the red jacket. I'm like, oh, no, sorry. I'm a kid from Australia. Anyway, you know, it's just things that you just learn as you go, and tenacity and, yeah, grateful for the, you know, you don't want to put, that was the incredible thing about New York is you get your studio, you know, on 23rd and 5th and you go, oh, didn't Stieglitz have a studio up there? Like you're in the footsteps of our heroes, you know, and walking into the Time Inc. building, you're like,
yeah.
how many of my heroes walk down these hallways, you know? So.
Yeah. It never ceased to amaze me. And it, every now and again, it surprises me. You're shooting at a studio and they'll say, oh, so-and-so is in the, you know, David Bailey's in the end studio today. And you're like, wow. So I just want to move into my little fast shutter speed questions that I like to do with whoever I'm talking to. Just because I think these tend to be the sort of photocentric things that a lot of, especially a lot of the younger photographers have been asking me to talk to people about. And some of them are a little mundane, but I think they're important in terms of understanding the sort of love and art of photography. So the first question I have for you is, do you have a favorite camera or have you had a favorite camera ever?
I think for a lot of us, it's the first one we got.
Right.
You know, my parents bought me a Canon TLB and that sat in a box and it's like, you know, that sort of, I think it's sitting in some box somewhere. It'll never be discarded or given away. That's probably my favorite camera because it's the first one that my parents, you know, came from. They didn't know what they were buying. They were hoping they bought some kids some decent camera and it's you know, the most basic camera. I don't really get that attached to cameras. I'm shooting with the new Fuji GFX and I think that's an astonishing camera.
Yeah, genius.
But they actually... Yeah. The reason why I knew that was a great camera, besides it's very fast and honest, like it's built like a camera should be. Like I gave it to my assistants when I first was testing it with a bunch of other cameras at that level. And I said, can you work that? Can you use that straight away? And they picked it up and they went, yeah, it's good to go. You didn't need, you know, there's all these fancy cameras and these menus that are bizarre and all these 4,000 billion settings. I'm like, no. I don't want that. I just want, does it open? Like, it's very basic. At the end of the day, a camera is a very basic concept. The hole opens, light goes in, gets trapped, move on. You know, it's not that complicated.
Do you have is there a favorite lens or focal length, which would probably be more?
Ooh, that's interesting. You're the second photographer who's asked me that.
Oh, really?
The first one was, it was really interesting. Mary Ellen Mark asked me that when I first met her.
I personally obsess more about focal length and then I do about cameras. I just, you know, to me it's the thing. It really is.
It's a sweet spot. Yeah. So on 30, like I'm 35, like maybe 28, just a little bit wider. I think I'm turning into one of the older photographers that like to go wider. Like Bill Brandt and all those guys, getting, you just watch their career and you're like William Klein and all these guys. You're like, they just got older and they must have got bored and like, oh, just give me the 15 mil. We'll see how that works on a headshot today. But yeah, maybe not that one, mate. Yeah. Like I found when I was shooting with the RZ, the 75 was a sweet spot.
Yeah.
It was a portrait lens, but it was just a little bit more connected. Maybe it got me closer to a human.
Right.
Because I can't shoot. Well, long lens puts me too far away from the subject. I struggle. I really find it takes me away from, like I like to be an arm's length when I photograph someone. I don't like to be much further away than that.
Right.
But that sort of locks me into the focal length. But
do you ever worry about, especially with portraiture and people you're shooting, you know, with just lens distortion and compression and stuff? No,
I don't. No, I find it fine. I mean, I find that when we go, this is the perfect portrait lens, I'm like, well, who are you to say that? Like, not you, but like, who are the camera and many camera manufacturers? Like, this is the world's most perfect focal length or portrait, right. And I go, oh, I'm glad you have that opinion, but maybe I'll have a different opinion, you know? And it's just probably like a bit wider than standard is my, you know, somewhere in that zone. Like even the Fuji right now, like, but also think about things that are not just about lenses. Like they've just finally come up with it. But the GFX has, I did a series of portraits of single mums and kids and with sons, and I ended up in a bunch of people's apartments. And like the focal length you need to photograph two people at a certain compressed state.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a distance thing. I kept coming to back to PhotoCare, the greatest photo store in the world. I went to New York that cares about people. And Jeff was like, sorry, mate. It's like, I said, yeah, but he goes, I'm not really like that. I was talking about the room constraints or the constraints of the room, not the lens. But also too, I shoot mostly with zoom lenses when I'm shooting the presidential stuff. Like I actually don't, because I find that most of those zoom lenses are great and everyone goes on about, you know, this lens and that lens. And yeah, clearly, you know, I'm not going to put a bad lens on my camera, but those zoom lenses enable me to shoot astonishing range of pictures very quickly. Fantastic.
Yeah. That's, you know what, that's left out of discussion in nearly every single camera review of a zoom lens. You know, the fact that, you know, someone like you who is using it on a high pressure situation needs to be able to not change lenses and not change cameras.
Desperately.
Get in and out. Right.
It's not just because I've got to give the magazine, like I got to go in and shoot a cover. I got to shoot inside. I got to shoot this. I got to shoot that. And every picture's kind of got to look a bit different. And here's another thing that's sort of a good industry inside conversation. As a magazine photographer, I own those images afterwards. I own the rights to those magazine pictures, right? So when I did those big Obama stuff early on in the campaign and I went in, like I shot Obama and there was Peter Yang was photographing Obama after me in another side of this stinky cow shed in North Carolina. And I had like six setups and I had like five different set. I knew every setup had to look radically different. A, to give Fortune a stack of pictures, but also it was my livelihood post that. All of a sudden, there were so many projects that those pictures got used on that seemed so different. And that lens, having a zoom lens, I can go from a longer shot for a headshot to a wider shot where they're moving his arms around.
Right.
You know, and Peter, who took a genius picture, an incredibly kind, wonderful photographer, you know, he had one setup with one lens. I'm like, why would you do that? Go on, do more.
Right.
You know? But the zoom lens gives me the ability, like sometimes people get like, oh my God, I can't believe you. That's just not pure. I'm like, okay, cool, good for you.
Oh my God.
That's pure for me.
And so this is what I'm uncovering completely with this series is that pros working, you know, people who are successful, literally have the most casual attitude because they use the stuff as tools. You know, literally it's a toolbox, and we throw them on, and they work for a reason. Whereas the, you know, the crazy sort of reviewing culture is obsessed with, you know, graphs and this and that thing, but it's not about pictures. Anyway, so I could go on about that.
Can I share one very, I'll try to, I'll condense
go for
this.
It.
The one day that changed, blew my mind about, I'd gone through working for all these geniuses though, who were technicians, incredible people. And then I got this assistant gig to help assist June Newton, Helmut Newton's wife, Alice Springs, as we know, is an Australian woman.
Yep.
Her story and his story are astonishing.
Yep.
And I had to assist June Newton shooting a Padma Lakshmi, the chef, Indian woman, beautiful, outrageously beautiful woman in the kitchen of the famous New York hotel on the Trump owned at one point, not the Palace, on the corner. Anyway, we're down there. Anyway, we're in the legendary kitchen. Yeah. And I was told that, you know, June's not that technical, so just let her do a thing.
Right.
And I go in there as a professional assistant, and I had a Polaroid back on the back of my 35mm camera, and I had my light meter, and, you know, they shoot not strobe because they want to see the light. Like, quite often she needs to see it. You know? And I'm out there, and she got the camera on it. She got, like, a really old beat-up camera on a tripod, and I'm jumping in with a light meter reading the light.
Right.
And she said to me, she looked at me, she goes, what are you doing? She's sitting on the chair. What are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just getting a... No. Come over here. And she points at the camera and she goes, it was like, you know, some amateur camera. She goes, guess what? There's a free one inside. And then I went, ooh, yeah, there is. And then she goes to shoot in an industrial freezer room. As we know, I knew that those lights were green, you know, like the vapor stuff.
Right? Yeah, right.
And they're going to put Padma on the floor with these like stakes or whatever she's got. And then I was like, June, it's going to be green. It's going to be a really nasty green. I said, you might like the green, but it's not green. It's not green. I'm like, oh, it's green. It's going to be green. And then I'm like, so she sets it all up. She sort of just pushes me away, sets it all up. And then I sneak a Polaroid and I show it to her. And she's standing there. She's got the whole American Vogue team. She's got this huge thing. And you could see, she looked at it and I was like, oh God, we're going to have to reset and change everything. And she just looked at me, she goes, oh, that is the most beautiful color of green I've seen in my life. And she goes, everybody come here. This green is the greatest green of all time. And I was like, you're a genius. Like that reset my thinking. You know?
Yeah. That's, oh my God. That's Helmut and June Newton story is extraordinary. And yeah, we could, you and I could probably talk about it for a long time, especially because the Melbourne connection and him shooting for Myers in Melbourne. Do you have any sort of really horror stories, shoot horror stories? Is there anything that really stands out as being a moment you were like, oh, I'm not sure I should be doing this?
So far, so good. I did work for a very patient genius still life photographer in Sydney, and I did show up one day a little had a late night, and he very kindly sat me down and said, don't ever do that again. So I'm grateful for that, Mr. Greg Belts. Thank you.
I've had a few Australian assistants that have ended up sleeping on my couch in the studio that I've got 2 a.m. So it must be a pattern. Yeah.
No, I felt terrible, and I'm grateful that you didn't fire me on the spot. But I had one really bad experience that wasn't, I didn't screw it up. I find that the worst situations are the ones that you didn't go hard enough, or you didn't fight hard enough to win.
Yeah.
You didn't push yourself. Like, I gave up too easily. And I've never had a catastrophic failure. I went early on, Premier Magazine hired me to go and photograph the actors at the Tribeca Film Fest. No, the Toronto Film Festival. And I had to go to there's a plane landing here in Sydney. There was the situation that was probably the most difficult for me in terms of biggest mistakes was Premier Magazine hired me to go and photograph actors in Toronto. And I was nervous and a bit insecure, and I went in with a controlling nature to deal with, like, you know, A-list actors, you know, 2 minutes in a hotel room, you know, Tom Cruise or Claire Danes or whatever's going on. And they just went, no, I'm not doing that. And I was so rigid in my way of working. I'm like, you're doing it. And then I didn't have a plan B, or I wasn't able to loosen up and go with them.
Right.
And I remember coming back from Toronto realizing that if I don't overcome that, I'm done. Like, I will not be a portrait photographer, or my dreams are done, because I can't handle the stressful moments. And the advice that I've given to other people is, I went, how on earth am I going to figure this? And I was talking to a mate who's an actor, and he said, well, go and do some acting courses. So I went and put myself into, I went to the improv comedy crew on 28th Street. There's all those comedy, those improv crews in New York. And I did a bunch of those courses of learning to be an actor, be an improv actor, which is understanding that to deal with pressure on the spot, to deal with spontaneity and stress.
Right.
And I was the world's worst improv comedy person. No one was ever going to be worried about my acting chops. But it gave me the ability to absorb the pressure, accept it, smile, and make it, and turn it into a positive experience, and then you'll be better. And I guarantee you, like that any advice to young photographers who hit the wall in terms of dealing with high stressful situations, go do that.
Yeah, that is brilliant. That's incredibly good advice, because I think that coming from a different place and being able to channel that's gold. That's really great advice for sure. Well, matey, thank you very much. I think we've covered all the topics that I wanted to, and I want to thank you for being a part of this.
Pleasure. Grateful to be asked. Thank you very much.
I'm
enjoying the series. I can't wait to listen to more.
It's
I won't listen to this one, but I'll listen to that.
Don't worry. You came up fantastic, so I'm super happy about it. But I want to thank you very much for being part of the Photorian, and I really look forward to seeing your next. I've sort of got a feeling about you, Mr. Baker, that there's going to be something kind of that's going to be a sort of a gold moment in your future. I can just feel that maybe I'm projecting because of I'm jealous that you're sitting in Sydney right now, and where it's going to be, what, say 40 degrees today or something, whereas I'm, you know, in the zeros. But I think that your career is taking you to a place that you've seen a lot and you've learned a lot. And now you can probably apply that in ways you probably figure out, and having that space and time in Australia is a great thing to do. So I applaud you for that. And it's been great to talk
to
you.
Thank you for your pleasure, and thanks for asking me, and stay safe and bring on 21. Let's all have a great, you know, the best year we can. We will.
So absolutely. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Very big thank you to Ben for being part of this week's Photorian. I highly recommend you take a look at Ben's portraiture. His images are really something very special. He seems to have an innate sensibility at bringing out a particular quality in those that he photographs. So if you enjoyed the conversation, please like and subscribe to the show. That would be great. And stay tuned for the next few episodes coming up with some more fascinating and interesting photographers. And so I hope you enjoy the show and look forward to being with you next week.